So we're going to continue luminol today. We are going to get through the rest of the procedure where we do get the compound to glow. Just to let you know ahead of time, you do not have to do a melting point. You don't have to do IR. It may ask you to do one or both of those things in the procedure, but skip it. This lab is for fun, you could say. So if you get it to glow, then you obviously made the stuff. So that's your characterization for this lab. Okay. In a similar fashion, this lab lecture is for fun, you could say, because you'll never see any of this that I'm about to show you again in organic chemistry. And some of you may never see it again for your life unless you take physical chemistry or some other more advanced chemistry or physics course. And some of you are saying, no way in hell, I am so outy once this course is over with, right?
Okay.
So this is not on the lab quiz. This is not on the final. This is not on any form of assessment. You still have the lab to finish, so you got to pretend to be interested for... Wow, see ya, wouldn't want to be ya.
Maybe an extra credit?
Wow, I should have told you that after the lecture, shouldn't I? The 7:30 class, they're so tired of waiting for the caffeine to kick in, they didn't think quite that fast like you all did. So they just kind of sat around, okay, wait, not on the lab quiz? Yeah. Well, now that we got that out of the day, what are we going to be studying out of interest? Well, first thing we're going to talk about is... Oh, yes. Oh, I see that you've taken some physics then. I see. Oh, yes. Was it the first semester? I don't know why I'm publicly admitting this type of thing. I think it was either the first or second semester or second semester of physics that I got in college. It was one of two C's I got in college. The other one was quantum mechanics, which I have forgiven myself for only getting a C in a graduate level quantum mechanics course, not having had the math. So, and if you could tell as much as I'm able to recount about quantum mechanics, and that's a C level, just imagine what an A level in quantum mechanics is like. Yeah, it's pretty far out there. So combining those two C's together, here's a lecture on that has nothing to do except with physics and quantum mechanics. And let's start with the physics part of it, the harmonic oscillator. So imagine that we have some kind of surface that is frictionless, in which there's no air resistance, in which there's no nothing. Just pretend that this is in a perfect vacuum with maybe some gravity to keep the weight from floating away or something like that. Imagine that we have a weight of some sort, an object, that is tied by a spring to this wall. And let's say that it has some rest position of zero. Is this sounding scary, like you suddenly got transported into physics class? Discuss the systematic and random errors of the system. No. What we're going to do, though, is imagine that we displace this object, that we move this object one way or another by some amount x. Those of you who haven't had physics before, what I'm attempting to do in very compact form is the way we would first present this idea of what the harmonic oscillator is. Because in this case, we're talking about some mass that's just sliding back and forth across a table. We could, to some degree, be talking about a pendulum moving. So if you haven't had physics before, think about the fact that if you lift the pendulum up, if there weren't air resistance or some other factors that we ignore, that thing would just keep going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth with a regular periodic motion. And it's that term periodic that's key and it'll come back to momentarily. So even if you haven't had physics, you must know that if you pull a spring a little bit, it tries to pull back a little bit. If you pull a spring a little bit more, it pulls back a little bit more. You pull a spring enough and eventually you might deform it. So, you know, this spring... The perfect behavior of the spring only goes so far, depending, again, on how far you displace it. But then once you release that spring, it's going to go oscillating back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Why? Well, let's try to put some of the math behind it. Because I'll just tell you that for the perfect spring system, we have this equation that some of you might be familiar with. F is equal to negative kx. What does this mean? Well, F is force. It means how hard is the spring pulling back? The spring is going to pull the opposite direction of the displacement, so that's why we got the negative sign in there. The K is a proportionality constant called the spring constant. So depending on exactly the type of material, length of spring and all that, that's going to determine how much tug there is to that spring. Now, we have to switch into physics slash calculus mode for a moment. So let me give you the baby version before we step up. Because force, you might know, even if you haven't had formal physics, can be as expressed as mass times its acceleration. Which, remember, that acceleration is the change in velocity over time. So how much does the speed change? Of course, speed itself is the change in position over time. So if you wanted to think of it that way, acceleration's like a double delta, because it's the change in the change. So if you have something cruising along at a constant speed, there's no acceleration. It's not changing its speed. So force is related to how is that force changing the speed of an object. Now going into calculus mode, if we say that force is equal to mass times acceleration, which is equal to negative kx. Well, acceleration is the second derivative with respect to time of position. This in calculus form is what I just said with the deltas a minute ago. That means that the change in the change in position is what I'm representing there. But it's related to the position of the object itself. And so this brings up an interesting problem in mathematics. What kinds of functions are the second derivatives of themselves? The negative second derivatives. Well, it turns out there's two classes of functions. One are the complex exponentials, which, oh, let me really rattle your cages, with the proper series expansion, could also then be shown to be related to sine and cosine functions. Now, these are not equivalent to each other. Those of you who had enough math know that this is part of the story, that you can get from one to the other with throwing some cosine in there as well. For everybody else, I'm just saying here are two functions that would actually fit this equation. And just for those who've had the math, let's remind ourselves. Second derivative of e to the ix would be I squared e to the ix, which would be negative e to the ix, which falls in that function. Second derivative of sine is negative sine. So again, it would satisfy this function. The point of showing you this little flourish of math is to show that mathematically we can model this movement of a spring back and forth like a sine wave. So the importance of the above set of equations is to demonstrate that the motion of an idealized spring can be modeled by a sine wave. Now, yes. It is omega x. Omega, oh gosh. It's related to angular frequency. How rapidly, if we're talking about a spinning object, is that thing spinning? That's what omega is related to. Which actually is the next step in this. That, you know, depending on how far we displace the spring, we're going to end up with different amounts of displacement, different speeds, different speed of oscillation. Well, the point there is that, in theory, we could displace the object a little bit, or a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, get all these different frequencies possible. In quantum mechanics, you can only have very specific energy values. But instead of having a mass attached to a wall like this, imagine you had two atoms attached to each other. This same model can be used to model ideally the behavior of two atoms vibrating. So the important point I was about to make is that in that case, you can't choose any energy that you'd want to. It has to be specific energy levels. That's the idea of quantization, of quantum mechanics, that you can put a packet of energy in, but you can't break it down to some small step in energy, anything smaller than that. So in atomic systems, energy is quantized. So only certain frequencies of vibration are allowed. And these would be the vibrational energy states. If we were to graph this somehow, then we would end up with something that looks like this. Now this is where my recollection of harmonic oscillators gets a little fuzzy. This was my quick review I did for lecture today. Ideally, this energy curve, if I plotted the effective displacement positions and energies of a spring, would look something like this. They'd form a parabola, so related to x squared, and the energy levels would start getting closer and closer and closer to each other. Kind of like the energy levels in atomic orbitals. Of course, these are two different things that we're talking about. These are vibrational levels. Have nothing to do with electrons, just with the nuclei moving relative to each other. That case I just said about atomic energy levels, well, that's what electrons are doing, which is a separate story that we're going to be coming back to. You just have never heard the story about these vibrational levels before. And so as a molecule is vibrating, it can speed up and slow down that vibration, but only by stepping between these different specific energy levels. And notice that there's a minimum energy level that you can't drop below, which is similar to the fact that electrons, again, I'm switching cases, electrons also have a minimum energy level that they can't get below. So this is, again, just demonstrating what these different vibrational levels look like. Now, what's this difference between ideal and actual? Well, again, as you stretch a spring to its breaking point, that ability to fight that deformation starts to get wordsmithing. Oh, gosh, here we go. As the spring is stressed too much, it can't respond the way it did, and so the symmetry of that vibration breaks down. In real life, stretch two atoms far enough, you break the bond. So at some point, they simply just don't vibrate, they just break. And that's partly what's in the shape of this curve. So all I'm showing you here is that there are vibrational energy levels, and that it can only have specific values. Now, this is if you only had two atoms that are simply vibrating relative to each other. If we had just three atoms, then we have to worry about modes of vibration. And this is all theory I really, really should have done back when we were first doing IR, but I was so worried about NMR back then. And in my own past experience, I got too much IR as an undergrad and not nearly enough NMR. So I might have overcompensated to give you too much NMR, but at least I'm going to patch up some of these holes in IR. Because if you have three atoms, and I happen to be drawing three circles, but when I did it this morning, I meant it just to be three atoms. I was drawing a circle to represent the atom. Maybe it's the molecule ozone. Why not? But it doesn't have to be. It's just three objects. Well, those two objects could have a scissor type of vibration where they open and close just like a scissor would. So the two bonds move relative to each other. Maybe they vibrate along the bonds. And you can have symmetric stretching. Maybe they still vibrate along the bonds, but as one zigs, the other zags. And so you end up with asymmetric stretching. What ends up happening then is that for one set of atoms, you can have many different modes of vibration. Which is obvious because we can take an IR of a sample and get all these different absorbances, which correspond to the variety of vibrational modes. The one thing that we've never talked about, nor have I tried to point out to you before, is that if we did have, for example, just hydrogen chloride, if we had the ability to take an IR of a diatomic gas molecule like that, we have IRs that are precise enough that they could actually capture and show you all of these different vibrational energy levels. We're not going to talk about this in the rest of today's discussion, but I just want to mention about rotational energy levels. Now imagine that we had that same molecule HCl. Imagine we talked about it rotating upon its axis. Just like vibrational energy levels are quantized, so are rotational energy levels. So this molecule cannot just have any speed of rotation it wants to. It can only have limited values of how fast it's rotating. And specifically, the value that's limited is angular momentum. So rotational energy levels are also quantized. Now notice that so far the whole discussion we had today is not looking at what happens to the electrons. Let's say the electrons have some configuration. Within that main energy level, there are then all these different vibrational energy levels that, again, I know we haven't talked about, which is why we're doing it now. And we also have these different rotational energy levels. Well, now let's focus on the electronic side of things. So all this vibrational stuff matters, and it actually matters for this luminol lab, but you don't know the connection yet. We're going to get there. We now have to have a discussion of electronic states, which we did talk about that last quarter some when we were talking about frontier orbital chemistry, when we were talking about homolumo theory. Last quarter, we talked about the ground state and we talked about the excited state. But I was trying to carefully avoid any discussion of what happens to the spins. Okay? So, you add energy. And what we talked about last quarter is, you can excite an electron up to an excited state. Now, here's the part I didn't talk about before. The ground state has a wave function associated with that orbital, where the electron comes from. The excited state has a wave function that's associated with that orbital as well. The transition from one orbital to another actually ends up being a big problem in what I would call classical quantum mechanics, which is kind of a weird term, but quantum mechanics didn't get invented overnight. That's an obvious statement. Meaning that what we look at and say, the wave function squared and this and that, that all came over many years of development. Things like the Pauli exclusion principle came after the idea of a wave function. So, they had to put all the pieces together. So one of the problems is this. Imagine back in Bohr's day, where he was coming up with the Bohr model of the atom, and if that was the model of which they were trying to get quantum mechanics from. You could have an electron in some orbital spinning around, and then there's this moment in time where all of a sudden it's at this other position, whizzing around. Now, wave functions are supposed to solve this Schrodinger equation, which I haven't referred to in forever. And there's lots of restrictions to what those wave functions should be, including that they must be continuous, that they must have first derivatives, that they must have second derivatives. There's some number theory behind it. What I'm trying to lead to is, in order for electrons to transition between energy levels, there must be some kind of, for lack of a better word, overlap between the wave function it's coming from and the wave function it's going to. If that overlap doesn't exist, then that electron doesn't have a way to move. And so there are what are known as selection rules in physics for this kind of situation, when electrons are moving between levels. Another way of saying it, there are what are known as spin-allowed transitions and spin-forbidden transitions. There's no way I can explain why easily, but as an electron moves just in one level like this, it's not allowed to change its spin. So let me try to put some of this down on paper and talk about what's the consequence of this. When an electron moves between energy levels, there are normally restrictions on how the spin can or can't change as the electron moves between levels. And some of these are, again, incorporated into these things called selection rules. And then we come up with these other phrases that I mentioned, such as spin allowed, transition. The spin-allowed transition is one that obeys these spin rules. And here's one of these rules. For moving up and down energy levels, a single electron must maintain its spin. So if you look at the picture I drew, you see in the ground state we have a set of paired electrons. In the first excited state, they're still paired in a sense. One's pointed the opposite way of the other. This is a situation in which the total angular momentum equals zero. Okay, so what's angular momentum? To oversimplify, how fast does something spin? It's not actually speed, it's momentum. But think of it, how much does something spin? We have one electron that spin up, one electron that spin down. So plus 1/2, minus 1/2. Put them together, that means the total spin between the two of them is zero. Here's another little side story. Back in atomic theory, so I know I'm giving you all this lead up about energy levels and I'm switching context suddenly, but that's because I got to give you where some idea of where these terms I'm about to use come from. Back in atomic structure, we have those four quantum numbers. Principal, angular, the orbital angular momentum quantum number, the magnetic quantum number, and the spin. That L value, the orbital angular momentum, what does that mean? That means not the electron in its little spin, but the whole thing, the electron itself. Effectively, how fast is that going around a nucleus? Well, when in that situation L equals zero, we say that we get an S orbital. You're like, okay, yeah. Well, if you have an S orbital, how many different kinds of S orbitals do you have in the same energy level? Just one, right? So when L equals zero, there's only one type of it. When L equals one, you know, that's one particle of energy used to move around the nucleus. Because the nucleus is three-dimensional, though, we get three unique cases. So for an L orbital, L equals one orbital, that's a P orbital, we end up with three of them. If we have L equals two, that's a D orbital, how many of them do we end up with? So in other words, we can figure out how many of those different orbitals, which means how many unique ways was that spin oriented, that's equal to 2N plus one, correct? The same thing happens here. That what is known as the multiplicity of spin states is related to the total spin by the equation 2s plus 1. So if our total angular momentum is zero, which means spin zero overall. There's only one way to have the number zero. And so we call this a singlet. Not the same kind of singlet as in splitting, but similar meaning. There's only one arrangement that occurs that way. If we go back up to this diagram that I had at the top, ground state would be S0, lowest energy singlet state. By default, if you have all paired electrons to begin with, then your ground state is a singlet state. The first excited state we could label S1, meaning still a singlet. The electrons did a spin allowed transition. They're just one energy level higher now. Are you still following along? No. That's good. No, I'll say it the same way I said in the morning section, because if any of you just got up and said, wow, this makes perfect intuitive sense, then I'd be jealous, because I don't get this at an intuitive level yet. And if you did, well, then there's something wrong with where each of us is standing and sitting, right? So if you don't get it, that's a good thing for me. If you are interested in this, then that's a good thing. Because maybe you'll want to go find out, wait, what is a triplet? What is that? What is that? You'll see where this is all leading very shortly. We're almost done with the techno babble. But there's one more thing I have to show you then. Because there are what are known as forbidden transitions, which means that the spin changes in a way that's normally not physically possible for the electron. So if it's not normally physically possible, why does it happen? We're going to come back to that answer, but notice that label I put on there. Because by parallel with what I did just above, the total angular momentum here is now 1. I use that same spin multiplicity equation, 2s plus 1, 2 times 1 plus 1 is 3. It turns out there's 3 unique ways that the total momentum in the system can be distributed to give that same total. Since there's 3 ways, that's why we call this a triplet. Now, if you're like me when I was an undergrad, this is really truly confusing. Because you might say, okay, I can understand that when the spins are paired with each other, a pair is a pair is a pair, there's only one way to do it, that gives you one way, that gives you a singlet. Then you think, okay, maybe the spins are both up, maybe the spins are both down. I could see where that gives me a total spin of 1. Then what's the third case? And it turns out it doesn't work that way. In quantum mechanics, when you start interacting spins, they create new systems, new sets of energy levels that are different than either individual spin. It's kind of like the same wording I use when we're talking about bonds. A bond is this new orbital that doesn't look like either atom, and yet we can use the two atoms to represent the bond. That's the kind of situation that's going on with spins. So to oversimplify, if I've got 2 spins, when they come together, there are 4 possibilities for interaction. 1 of those is the singlet state. The other 3 have the same total momentum, and so that's why it's a triplet state. So how do we put all these pieces together? No, because I need it closer up here. There we go. Because notice what I'm going to try to do. I'm kind of trying to draw it in such a way that between these different systems, there's overlap. So now let's look at these labels and talk about what this is. S0, that's the ground state. That's a singlet. Electrons are paired. You pump a photon into them. It takes you up to the next highest singlet state. What can happen then is it might fall down in energy a little bit from one vibrational level, slowing down to the next, slowing down to the next. At some point, it loses the right packet of energy where the electron falls back down to the ground state. Maybe to the same vibrational level it started, maybe a slightly different one. So this means that the exact frequency absorbance or release, there might be a little wiggle room too, just because there are these different vibrational levels. I found out that not only am I getting old, I'm getting culturally insignificant, I guess. Because something that was just an obvious thing to me this morning, I had to tease out that people didn't even know what they were until I described it in such strange ways where they finally said, oh yeah, that. Do any of you know what a black light poster is? Okay. Raise those hands up. Now let me describe it again. Do any of you know what one of those posters that's normally colored in sort of neon-looking colors that if you shine the purple-looking light on it, it glows more than it normally would? Which is a black light poster. Have any of you ever seen these purple-looking light bulbs? Have any of you ever been to Small World at Disneyland or some other theme park and you're riding through on the rides and you look down and you realize that your white clothes all of a sudden are really glowing, really bright? Okay, so now you're all going, oh, that. That's what I'm talking about, because people don't know what blacklight posters are because we're not in the 60s anymore, which I never was in the 60s, but that's where you saw an awful lot of them, because the two places you usually see these posters are little kids' room, because they're all bright and glowy, and, well, certain stores off of Berkeley, because certain types of Berkeley people like things that are bright and glowy. That is what's going on. Because you shine the black light, which is a UV light of a shorter frequency, somewhere in the range of 235, 270, something like that. It gets absorbed by the molecule. Maybe it loses some of its energy before it falls down because it transitions between different vibrational states. When it finally releases that photon of energy again, it's a different color than what you observed originally. And this process is called fluorescence. Fluorescence is nothing more than spin-allowed release of a photon from one higher energy singlet state to a lower energy singlet state. Because these are spin-allowed transitions, they're extremely fast. Turn the light off, the glow stops. And again, because the energy of absorbance is not necessarily the same as the one that's released, you shine UV light, but you see all these different colors come back. There's your glow-in-the-dark posters. Not glow-in-the-dark, glow-in-black light. Because glow-in-the-dark is something else. How many of you have ever been in theater before? Which, again, this morning they're like, theater. You mean the movie theater down the street? No. Theater as in acting, you know? Broadway, same difference, you know? Have you ever been anywhere that's had tape where you shine a light on it, just normal daylight, and then you put it in darkness and it glows? How does it glow? How does what? Can light be black? No. It's just called that way because UV light you can't see, but it makes something glow, so it's light. So it's not black, but it's dark. It's this dark purple. So yeah, it's called black light, but no, it's not black. You know, English. English is that kind of language. We park in driveways and drive in parkways. You know, we say we're cleaning up, but that would mean we're cleaning the ceiling. The floor is down there, so why the hell are we cleaning up? You know, that's just the way English is. We can't help it. We're just, it's not our fault. Someone else did it. So now back to this story. What these things like the glow tape, the reason I said theater is because in theater you use this glow tape that in the light, it absorbs light. Lights go out, you can still see it glowing. Why? Because you can have a spin forbidden transition if the vibrational states are similar enough to each other. That's why we went on this whole story about what vibrational energy levels are. In other words, you pump energy into a molecule. It has an electronic level, but it's also got a particular vibrational level. If that vibrational level just happens to match with another vibrational level of one of these forbidden states, then the spin can flip, even though it's not supposed to, even though it's technically impossible to. That's because if you only look at quantum mechanics, yeah, it tells you it can't happen. But quantum mechanics does not happen in a stationary system. It happens in a vibrating molecule. And these vibrational effects sometimes allow what is referred to as inter-system crossing. So what can happen with these glow-in-the-dark objects is you shine light on it. It absorbs a photon in the way that it's supposed to, a spin-allowed transition. It then can cross over to the triplet state if its vibrational level between the singlet and triplet happen to match. For a triplet to get back down to the ground state, is one of these forbidden transitions, and it's called phosphorescence. Since it's spin forbidden, it's much more difficult for it to occur. That's why when you add this light energy to one of these glow-in-the-dark objects, it causes all these electrons to go into an excited state, which because they then transfer to a triplet state, they can't get back to the ground state right away. You turn the light off, and the electrons are still falling for a long time afterwards until finally it runs out of energy again. That's phosphorescence. So what I've just given you is a description of fluorescence, phosphorescence, two ways that light can be generated by an object, by its electrons falling from high energy to low. There are two ways it can fall, an allowed way, that's fluorescence, which means it stops as soon as the light goes off, and phosphorescence, which is not a physically easy path for the electron to take, which is why it takes much longer for the energy to be released, which is why it lasts a while. So there, you had to wait to get through all this technobabble, but there was a point to all that. Of course, we still haven't quite gotten to the point of what makes the luminol glow, which is chemiluminescence. I used a more arbitrary example for the class this morning than I read the silly lab manual like I really should, and found out that the molecule I used for my example was almost identical to true luminol. So I'm going to look one last time so that for the rest of time, I'll have the structure of luminol memorized. No, what they did is, what they saw as their example, because I just wanted to talk about the chemistry really briefly, but not got bogged down into it. So I took a cyclohexane ring and showed them what I'm about to show you. Except I'm showing you the real version. Because instead of something to do with cyclohexanol, let's take phthalic acid. Which, what is phthalic acid? An acid. Very good, Leonardi. It's a benzene ring with what on it? If you say an acid again, then you're not going to get the cookie a second time. And another carboxylic acid group. What about the thalamide Gabriel synthesis? Oh, so the same phthalic acid. If you have 3-aminophthalic acid, we reacted it with hydrazine and heat to dehydrate and form a double amide. Which is luminol, which you then react to decompose. Now, the rest of this, as far as the intermediate products, you can look in your lab text to get, because the mechanism of decomposition I'm not interested in. I do want to point out that you did make amides to do this, but we also have this nitrogen-nitrogen single bond that results. And hydrazine is unusually reactive, and I might not have pointed out why before. Think of this as the nitrogenous equivalent of a peroxide. Peroxide, that oxygen-oxygen bond, is unusually reactive. Even if you had a carbon-oxygen or a hydrogen-oxygen bond, they may be reactive, but not the same way that peroxides are. Same type of thing here. Nitrogen-carbon bond, very different creature than a nitrogen-nitrogen bond. So it's partly the decomposition of that feature of the molecule that causes luminol to do its thing. In the context of the discussion I showed you above, the important thing to realize is that when this decomposes, it puts exactly the right amount of energy into the exactly right electronic and vibrational states that when this molecule decomposes, it causes light to be released. And that's chemiluminescence. And let's see, this says technically it is oxygen, really. That causes us to glow. So the reaction of luminol causes an intermediate with the exactly correct energy and structure. To allow that energy to be released, in the form of a photon. What could be called radiative decay. Non-radiative means that it happens through vibration or some other physical way without light being released. So this process is therefore chemiluminescence, which sometimes chemiluminescence can involve singlet states, sometimes it can involve triplet states. If I remember correctly with luminol, because I think I've got this, sorry, section one, I think I got this backwards for section one. Well, actually, it's right here in your lab book. When the reaction occurs, this is a little bit backwards. This is an unusual case where it goes into a triplet state first. Let me read this really quick. So it forms a triplet first, which takes a while, and it goes back to the singlet state and then emits light. But that inter-system crossing takes some time, which is why the glow lasts for a little while. So all of this I've presented today, you could say, is the background explanation for how things like glow sticks work. So the next time that you're at a party where someone asks you, hey, how does this glow stick I've got work? You can do as I did once, which was when I was at such a party and there was someone who asked me, and that someone was not in the most sober conditions, and he made the mistake of asking, how does that work? And I felt in the mood, and so I told him.
What happened?
I'd never seen someone so confused and stunned at the same time, because he just didn't know what to say, because he wasn't in the condition to say much. So, yes. It's a beautiful question. I should know the answer to, and I can attempt to do it on the spot. He asked, what's the difference between a halogen light and one of these, like a mercury vapor lamp even, or these different compounds that are the gases inside of there, which what I assume happens is depending on the different vapors, you have different excitations between energy levels, which gives you the different kinds of light. And of course, those different components, and depending on the proportion, you get what are different called different white points. If you go buy a light bulb, you look at the back, it'll say it's a 4,000 Kelvin bulb, or it's a 2,500 Kelvin bulb, which is a type of white produced by a flame that's that heat that gives you a certain proportion of blues versus reds, so that if you're putting on makeup versus on stage versus in here, you want different kinds of white to see different palettes of colors. So I presume that those different components are put in there to achieve those different balance of colors. Sodium's yellowish from what I remember, which would be a low white point color, like the 2000s, 1500s. Halogen, I think, is a more energetic reaction, so that would give you a bluer light, more in the 4000 range, I think.
And in relation to how much heat
that would be the what's called the efficiency of reaction. So that's a big deal in solar panels, for example. Light hits a solar panel, this tiny portion of it actually gets converted into electricity. Most of it's just wasted. So if somehow we could raise the efficiency, that means we could take a roof full of voltaic panels and reduce it down to that size. Or keep it the same size but get that much power out of it. That's why solar technology is still maturing, because we're figuring out how to increase that efficiency. Again, not being a light expert, I'm kind of guessing, but it's kind of logical guesses based on what little I've read. Yes? There's different ways that it can happen, and I'd rather actually research that if I was going to answer a question about how it happens, because I have two friends that that's what the research is, and they could tell me all about it, and then I can give you a real answer. Now, back to the luminol, though. We've finished the story. So what you're going to be doing now is well, I have to, no, you're going to make it glow, but you have a little bit more work left than I thought. And it is purely my fault, because I looked at this former procedure, and I remembered that there was a clear stopping point where if you didn't finish up, if you did finish up, it didn't matter. I, in my haste to get you all going, remembering that they didn't quite finish in one day, was like, okay, get that first paragraph done, which is only the first half of it. Because the second paragraph is not the glowing part, it's finishing making the stuff. Which, that was my oops. But you will have time to both finish that today and make it glow. They all had the time, and I think everybody, if not everybody, enough people had a successful glowing reaction that nobody came up and was all pouty-faced and said, I didn't get it. So if they did happen, again, I didn't note it didn't happen, but everybody hopefully is going to get something to glow. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to put the procedure for that second portion of the lab up. Let me tell you a couple things about it. You don't need to save any of it to dry out carefully because you're not taking a melting point. So there'll be a portion of that procedure where it says put some aside, don't worry about that. Convert the whole part. Once you're done writing that down, once everybody's moved on, I'll then move it to the part where it talks about making it glow. When we get there, it talks about measuring out a specific sample size. Don't. Just take a chunk of your luminol, throw it in, and do the following. It talks about putting potassium hydroxide pellets. The advice I got from an instructor was, have lots of those potassium hydroxide pellets, but have a minimum amount of the DMSO that it recommends. Which, if you don't remember what DMSO is, here's the structure. Dimethyl sulfoxide. I'll tell you a story that my chemistry teacher told me, so I guess it's true, but I've never tried it, because I think DMSO is supposed to be slightly toxic in its own right. But the trick is, if you had something like garlic, and you rubbed it on someone's skin, and then you smacked a little DMSO on them, that you'll taste the garlic, because the DMSO is so easily permeates the skin, and it brings the garlic along for the ride, that it gets into your bloodstream, and then you can taste garlic. Now, again, I haven't tried this to know that it's true. I've also heard of its murder mystery variation, which is to do it with cyanide instead. Yeah. Notice we don't actually ever put cyanide for any of you all out to play with. Point of the story is that DMSO is not necessarily a safe thing to have. Even if itself is not so bad, it's because it could get other things to dissolve in. So no, you can't take these home to show your friends. And they won't last that long anyways. If you really want to show them, go buy a glow stick. Ouch. Was that a phone? Oh, dear. So treat these solutions somewhat carefully. The reason I'm saying this is because you're going to have this layer of potassium hydroxide. You're going to have as little DMSO as you can get away with to cover those pellets. You'll have your luminol. I think there's one other component. And then you need to vigorously shake it. The more shaking, the more glowing you're going to get. Don't even think about using your thumb or even a gloved thumb to do it, though. You want to make sure you have a proper stopper. Proper stopper. Because of the DMSO. You got it? Everything's going to be base waste today because you're going to be smothered in potassium hydroxide. So none of it goes in organic. It's going to go into the base waste. Including whatever excess luminol, yeah. Although, if you get to that point, don't leave excess, because again, you can't take it home. Make it all glow. and go show the Chem 1A people and say, look, if you suffer through this many quarters of chemistry, you get to have 5 minutes of fun. Woohoo!
I think it's time to get to work.